Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We shouldn't be under any illusion that there are some very different visions of how these new critical technologies should be applied and can be applied. There's a very different value set and vision of what they can achieve in comparison to what we would like these technologies to do for our societies.
G'day. Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this program, Tobias Feakin, Australia's Ambassador for Cyber Affairs and Critical Technology, joins Professor Rory Metcalfe to unpack the government's recently launched International Cyber and Critical Tech Engagement Strategy. Prior to his ambassadorial appointment, Dr. Feakin was the Director of National Security Programs at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute from 2012 to 2016, where he established the Institute's International Cyber Policy Centre. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Now, let's get into it.
Welcome to the podcast, Ambassador Tobias Feakin, who's Australia's Ambassador for Cyber Affairs and Critical Technology. It's a great pleasure to welcome you on this program, our Security Summit series, where we talk to leaders, thought leaders, and policy leaders in this space. Now, you've got a job that involves many, many objectives. You wear multiple hats, I guess, in a way. You have to deal with so many stakeholders to prosecute Australia's national interest. But I know that foremost in your mission at the moment is advocating this new strategy, Australia's International Cyber and Critical Technology Engagement Strategy. So I thought, let's hear a little from you to begin with up front about that strategy, but then I'd like to wind back a little bit and find out a bit more about, you know, the context of making policy in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Rory, thanks so much for having me here. It's a real pleasure to be at the NSC and to talk to you about obviously what I believe are some of the most important issues going on in the world today. But it's we do, you're right, in saying the foreign minister just 2 weeks ago now launched our International Cyber and Critical Technology Engagement Strategy. And I think it's good to say, well, why do you need something like that? What's the point in having an international outlook on these issues? Put quite simply, it's a reflection of the fact that cyber and critical technology, and what do we mean by critical technology? It's those technologies that have a direct impact on our national interest, whether it be economic, security, or our social cohesion. You know, there's a whole load of other terms bandied around, like emerging tech, but, you know, not all emerging techs are going to be critical to our national interest, and that's where the definition lies. Well, these issues now in the global context are becoming ever more central to geopolitical power shifts and the contestability of the international environment writ large. So really it's a statement of, well, what is it Australia wants in that international environment? What is it that it wants to shape, and how is it going to go about that? And, you know, genuinely it's needed now more than ever, and you're seeing increasingly that other countries, whether it be UK through their integrated review, whether it be through various other mechanisms from other like-minded partners, they're all thinking about these issues and beginning to strategize around it. But we really are genuinely into the period now, I think, of grand strategy on cyber and tech issues in a way that we've not really seen in recent history.
That's a pretty big definition for a country like Australia, which I guess has sometimes been a bit cautious about the idea of grand strategy, a middle power or a middle player or a top 20 countries we're sometimes called. Australia has played and is playing, I would argue, quite a lead role on these issues internationally. So I guess two follow-up questions to that. One is, what? Firstly, how has this strategy advanced beyond, you know, what I know was a previous international cyber strategy that Australia put forward in 2017, I think, and that you played a major role in. But also, what does leadership look like in this space for a country like Australia?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, look, I think Australia has played a strong role in the international environment for quite some time. You could look back to the 2016 cybersecurity strategy as really setting up the basis for this position. And the government at the time really, you know, shooting the priority up through the stars in terms of how government was thinking about cybersecurity and about beginnings of the broader tech environment. And then it was also through a whole range of decisions, you know, the 5G decision here, some of the really excellent policy that was made through Home Affairs and the Australian Signals Directorate on that front has really set a benchmark, which, you know, internationally countries are intrigued by and want to learn from us and understand, well, what is it that's special in Australia? Why are we, you know, feel like reaching for the stars in this area? Because there is genuine, you can feel that where in this job. It's been a real privilege to see that on the road, how other countries do look now to Australia to set a marker out there on various issues. So in terms of this strategy, where does it differentiate? So in 2017, when I first came into this position, one of the requirements of the job was to create a strategy around what it was we wanted in cyberspace. What were the key things we wanted to achieve there? I won't go through all the details of that, but it's all the things, again, that you'd expect. You know, how do we make the most of the digital economy? How do we ensure good cybersecurity with our partners around the region? How do we deal with the international security environment? How do we combat cybercrime? How do we ensure that human rights are upheld online? It was a very wide-reaching piece of work and important at the time. But what we've seen in the interim period is that you couldn't escape a conversation around cyber affairs, cyber issues writ large without suddenly these terms of, you know, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, blockchain, whatever it might be, you know, pick your term. It kept on coming up in the conversation. You couldn't escape it. And then telecommunications, future telecommunications, 5G issues becoming front and center. And it was just, you couldn't avoid the fact that we needed to understand, well, what does this look like in its broadest sense? And what is it that we as Australia want to do in the international environment? What do we need to shape? So, you know, what is it that we can do as Australia? What is the role that we can play? Well, you know, we are very good in certain key technology areas. We have some amazing capability, but we aren't a key startup hub. We aren't a Silicon Valley. We aren't a Beijing. We aren't, you know, some of those other big hubs like Tel Aviv, for example. But we do have a voice in shaping what technology looks like once it's absorbed into societies. And I think that's where our value add really comes. We can help shape that environment. Certainly we do distinctly at a domestic level. Well, how can we take that out into the international environment and ensure that many of these technologies that are being developed at an incredibly rapid rate of knots, how do we ensure that when they're absorbed into the global system, that they're absorbed into that system in a way which doesn't negatively affect our societies? Because, you know, we shouldn't be under any illusion that there are some very different visions of how these new critical technologies should be applied and can be applied. There's a very different value set and vision of what they can achieve in comparison to what we would like these technologies to do for our societies and, if you like, maintain some of the values that we hold dear. That's not a vision that's shared. And I mean, we can definitely dig into that a bit more, if you like, in the conversation. But, you know, that's at the heart of this strategy. And it's an important expression of our policy and our thinking in this area so that we can share that with other countries and try and be as forward-leaning as possible. Because, you know, this is a requirement of modern government. And certainly if governments don't have strategies like this now, they're in the process of developing them.
So let's open up a bit of that further. I think you talk about the world that Australia wants to see. You talk about the role of diplomacy, and maybe we can go a little bit to the mechanics of how that works, because you know these are mysteries to a lot of people, and the world that Australia wants to see, as opposed to perhaps the vision that we may be up against, including from authoritarian countries. But first, I want to go back to a point you made about Australian leadership in this space is partly simply about using and sharing the example of what we've done domestically in the international space. It'd be good to have a few practical examples, if you like, of you know what are some of the Australian policy initiatives or achievements in this space that you particularly like to promote in the international context?
Look, yeah, there's a whole range, but I think I will take the obvious example that I'd already flagged, which is around our 5G decision-making process. In Australia, that feels like a considerably long time ago that decision was made, but there's still so many countries who are still in the process of working out what their future telecommunications architecture looks like. And so it's still very relevant. And talking through why did we make that decision? Why did we make it when we did? And what was the basis of that decision? Has been incredibly helpful in explaining to other countries who are, to be frank, you know, caught in a quandary of what they should do. And I think you know that's one of the biggest areas of policy that we've shared. Another way in which we've push the envelope is not just through taking domestic policy and sharing that with others, but also looking at the international environment and trying to be forward-leaning in what we then say in a policy context. And one way in which we've done that is through the discussion on international law and norms, through the UN processes where, credit to my colleagues across government in the way that they've come to the party and really tried to progress what's being said by government, by our government, in order that it creates more transparency with other countries in the international environment, whether it be about our offensive cyber capability, whether it be about the application of international law to cyberspace, whether it be about how we implement 11 norms of behavior that were agreed at the UN in 2015. We've tried to make that as practical and clear and as accessible to as wide an audience as possible in the hope that others start, as I say, coming to the party and doing the same.
So just for clarity for listeners to the podcast, because of course a lot of our listeners are Australian, some of our listeners are not Australian, and it's great to know that we're projecting some analysis and insight internationally. And the 5G decision was several years ago. I think it was August 2018, if I remember rightly. What were the contours of that decision exactly?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, well, I mean, it starts from the premise that providing 5G infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure, is one of the most significant infrastructure builds that any country is going to make, because 5G architecture will be the underpinning of most digital tools that we will use in the immediate and near future, whether it be Internet of Things devices, driverless cars, and all of these things that we know are in high-end development and will soon be with us. 5G will enable those because it will enable a much faster moving connected environment than we currently have. And in terms of the decision that Australia made, it was on the basis of, well, what does that 5G architecture look like once it's fully matured, once it's fully operational and having to enable, for example, driverless cars? And the decision that was made was that, well, you couldn't allow high-risk vendors into the core of that network and hope that you could, if you like, buffer it from the less important parts of the network, because the whole network becomes vital. For example, you wouldn't want a driverless car suddenly dropping out of signal and then becoming a liability wherever it's driving. So essentially, you couldn't allow high-risk vendors into the network. And also, there was perhaps a term, you couldn't allow a fox into the hen house. So if you can make those kind of risk mitigation decisions in advance, well, why wouldn't you make those? It's not a traditional cybersecurity issue either. So, there's a lot of cybersecurity risk mitigation measures which were looked at and examined, but were pushed to one side. It was realized that they weren't applicable. So in the end, you also need to look at the decision in terms of, well, you know, what about your economic security? If this architecture is going to underpin your economic future as well, which it will, again, can you accept a certain degree of risk with a high risk vendor inside that network? And the decision came back to no in the end. And if you like, that's at a very top level, and it's not the entirety of the basis of the decision, but it begins to give you the understanding of why those decisions were made. Now, being a first mover in terms of making those decisions has allowed, in my view, the telecommunications sector here to take advantage of that, mature their 5G networks, and put us in a great place as a nation to innovate around that and then share that innovation globally. So if you like, take us that one step beyond the decision and more into, well, what is it that 5G can offer us? And I think that's optimistically where we're heading now.
And that's also, apart from anything else, a fantastic case study into the way in which economics and security are so intertwined now, you know, that essentially economic policy is security policy and vice versa, which
absolutely
a useful aside for students at the National Security College who are trying to work through through these things. I want to go back to values, if we may, because you've, or values and vision, if you like, because you've talked a little bit about the, you know, the vision for the way in which cyber and critical technologies are developed in the world and are really put to the service of societies and businesses and states. And there is an Australian vision, which is not exclusively Australian. There are other countries that I'm sure are like-minded with us, at least on some of these issues, that is grounded in values. There's a lot about values and what I would see as liberal democratic principles in the strategy that, that you've developed and that you're advocating. Can you talk a bit more about that connection between values and the vision that Australia sees for technology in the world?
Absolutely. And I think it goes to our discussion around, you know, the geopolitical contestability of technology and the fact that there are some very different visions of what critical technologies will do for us, and both for various nations and more broadly as a global society. And some of those visions don't fit with the values that we hold dear. And part of this is equipping anyone who picks up this strategy and giving them the ability to engage in a technology discussion. You know, you don't need to be a deep subject matter expert in AI, for example, to be able to discuss some of the ethical principles that should be thought about when you're developing AI algorithms, for example. And so this strategy lays out what some of our core values are as Australia, whether that be, you know, upholding human rights principles, about ethical design of technologies, about gender and diversity issues being built into tech, upholding international law and norms in technologies. You know, those kinds of principles, along with liberal democratic values more broadly, we think are incredibly important in terms of baking them into technology design, but also baking them into the way in which technologies are absorbed into the international context. And so that's why we place them at the outset. And you know, it's no secret. You look at the way some other countries with a more authoritarian vision of how technologies can be used, they certainly aren't being applied with the same values that we would here. And then when you take that out into the global context, that's why we have such a focus on issues like standard setting in technology, which is very much more a focus of government again now. Because, you know, if you look at standard setting bodies, those values are being intertwined in some of the technology standards that are being discussed and looked at being implemented in the global setting. So we need to be thinking as a first principle, what are the values that we want to embody and what that we want technology to deliver for us. And interestingly, in the process of developing this strategy and talking to a huge number of private sector entities, both here and internationally, there was quite clear feedback from certain companies, which was actually, you know, for Australia as a nation, if for us, what we want to just understand very clearly are, what are the value sets that you stand for? Because we'll innovate around those value sets and, you know, obviously the legislation too that you have in play. But just understanding what you stand for as a nation makes it much easier for us to innovate around. So, you know, hopefully it can prompt that kind of innovation cycle too. And often the example was used with a couple of companies that I spoke to when I was in Europe They were operating in Germany, and they said, look, it's really easy innovating here. Germany has very strict principles around privacy, around encryption, and a number of other things, and that's all we need to know. And on that basis, we are doing very well in terms of coming out with some really interesting products that then get absorbed into that society. And so it's an attempt to express that. And so, you know, anyone engaging with us has a clear understanding of those values.
And incidentally, this discussion seems to, I guess, balance the assumption that some make that, if you like, there is commercial advantage in having a very loose adherence to liberal democratic values, or even really innovating against those values. It sounds as if that values and commercial advantage can go hand in hand in some circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you raised the issue already around industry's role, and we've been talking about industry innovating around values. But let's be under no illusions as well. Some of the big multinational tech firms, at times it's hard to put a finger on exactly what those values and principles are, because they often do seem to shift depending on the market environment that they're looking to operate in or build a business in. So I see no issue with the fact that we as a government state, these are values that we expect you to be upholding if you're going to be dealing in our environment. And, that's a big part of this job as well, is getting out and talking to some of the big multinational tech firms and trying to just get to a better sweet spot in terms of, where they're heading with their technology cycles, some of the policy decisions that we're making, explaining that to them. And an initiative that we kicked off with the Danish tech ambassador — they have an ambassador which is posted in Silicon Valley. We kicked off this piece of work in 2019. Is a cyber and tech retreat, where we take 25 of these kinds of positions from around the world. We place them in the backyard of Silicon Valley. We call it the Golden Gate Group, and engage one-on-one with some of the most senior tech characters that you would know and love from your TV screens, and have a pretty pointy conversation with them around particular tech policy related issues, trying to create that environment where you can have a hard, tough decision conversation, whilst feeling relatively, if you like, a safe space to do so. And it's — I know a lot of our my colleagues around the world get incredible value out of it. And increasingly, you're seeing the tech industry understand the importance of a conduit like that for those conversations. You'll see now, like, the tech industry has comprehensively shifted. Whilst they're still playing a bit of catch up, I think, from a policy point of view, that they're growing their policy teams at a huge rate of knots.
And that's actually a really important observation, that the industry's shifted, and we'll see if we can come back to that if there's time. And I just note, even looking at the strategy document, that the way it looks at values, it categorizes or it classes them in categories of democratic principles, of human rights, of the ethics, of critical technology, of diversity and gender equality. I wonder if you could just maybe elaborate on a few of those, including, for example, in relation to privacy and human rights. What's special about the Australian approach?
Yeah, look, what's special about the Australian approach is, firstly, I think that we're willing to put these things down on paper and stand for them. I would say that, a lot of these values are common values that we share. Not all of them, but we share with a whole range of our like-minded partners. And I think, again, the idea here is to not overcomplicate them. With a value like human rights, it should be a simple equation. Human rights apply online equally as they do offline. And I think if you take that very simple explanation of each of the values, that's exactly how we should be explaining them, so that they're simple constructs. And, it's just saying, this is common sense. And this is what Australia feels should exist in the international environment. Now, does it exist everywhere? No, and that's why we feel that it's important to champion those. And I think at this stage, it's trying to equip as many people as possible within the Australian government and amongst a kind of broader stakeholder environment that we work with to now take these words on board and then utilise them in their engagements internationally.
We'll be back after this short break.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
I want to come back to the industry thing again in a moment and the stakeholders and the extraordinary amount of engagement and consultation that you have to do, not just you personally, but you and your team and colleagues who work as diplomats and policymakers in this space. But I want to first go to diplomacy because it's great to have a strategy. It's great for Australia to be out there advancing its position, building coalitions, trying to get outcomes. But multilateral diplomacy, as we all know, can be pretty agonising work. I have had a little bit of experience in the past of multilateral diplomacy in the arms control space. You know, I guess more in the WMD world, where there is a theory, there is a view that as soon as countries begin to negotiate away advantage in a particular class of weapons, it's because really they don't see advantage of that anymore. They're not actually giving anything up. In cyber and critical tech, of course, this is a universe that is rapidly evolving and expanding, and it's now deeply intertwined with state power and with the geopolitical quest for advantage. So how do you get outcomes in multilateralism on these issues when there are some countries that are presumably very determined to achieve different outcomes, when there needs to be an enormous amount of energy and attention to detail, and where I guess in many cases your outcomes are going to be quite provisional? You know, is there a, to use a term that's been used a lot in diplomacy lately, is there a secret sauce to how we do multilateral diplomacy on cyber apart from endless reserves of energy?
What's the secret sauce in this area? Now, look, in the context that you describe, you know, UN discussions around international law and norms, I would say it's the same recipe. It's hard yards. It's slow. It's looking very carefully at commas and words that are used and trying to understand the meaning that someone's using behind a particular phrase and why they want that inserted into a particular document or into a particular paragraph. That doesn't go away. That's still there. But you're right in pointing out there's the danger in all of that, because there's some countries that use that to their advantage and they want this discussion to go on as long as humanly possible. Because what that does in a fast technology shifting environment, what that does is allow them huge flexibility in their operating environment, which means that they can conduct all sorts of malicious activity whilst we're stuck at the table negotiating X, Y, or Z. Now, if we take the cyber domain as an example, interestingly, actually, it was the Russians who really kind of created the whole cyber diplomacy area back in 1998. My Russian counterpart, who's still around now, he went to the UN and introduced the idea that we should be talking about information security and how it could cause an international catastrophe. And I think those are pretty much his actual words he used at the time. So since 1998, we've been discussing these issues at the UN. And in 2013, chaired by Australia, there was a UN group of government experts that agreed international law applied in its entirety, including the entirety of the UN Charter. And then in 2015, 11 norms of behavior were agreed, which we've always published and adhered to ourselves. And those, we feel that that's pretty much all that we need. You know, a bit more granularity in terms of how international law applies is incredibly helpful and useful, but the basis is there. What you see, though, is that, you know, that protracted discussion is being drawn out in the hope that we can a particular set of countries would like to draw us into a very protracted treaty-based discussion, which then is dragged out over the course of 10 years. And in the meantime, you know, you'll get to the end of that, and the end result will be a set of words which don't apply to the technology that's been then developed within 10 years, i.e. it creates more opportunity for grey zone. And, you know, questionable activities in cyberspace and beyond. So, you know, this is almost the dichotomy that we're in. Technology shifts so quickly, but the international debate at times just doesn't quite keep up with that. That's not to say, I mean, somewhere like the UN now is entirely on board with the whole concept of digital and cyber, but and you can see a proliferation of discussions that are going on. The UN Secretary General is very much taken with this discussion and on board. We do a huge amount of work through ASEAN regional forums on these issues as well, and there's been a great deal of progress there. So we are making progress. Is it quick enough? No. It always seems, again, especially in cyberspace, that the advantages with, if you like, those who are willing to conduct offensive operations and not, you know, put that on the table in a transparent way I don't mean all of their operations, but, you know, being willing to say that they own offensive capability and those are the parameters under which they will use them. So, I mean, as policymakers, you know, I'm a big believer that we need to create policy frameworks that provide us with flexibility to be able to absorb new technologies, new critical technologies when they come up. And so, you know, whilst it's a fairly lengthy document, you'll see that it's not incredibly prescriptive in masses of detail about every individual technology. It's about having broad principles which could apply and be flexibly applied to new critical technologies as they come, you know, online and stream. And that's, you know, this is not easy territory for governments. You know, we like to do things methodically. You know, we do move very quickly at times, but, you know, tech, and this is drawing on a background I've had on tech policy for, you know, 25 years now. It's scary to say that to you, to be honest, Rory. Governments at times find it hard to have that flexibility with these kinds of technologies and using them themselves and creating effective policy around them. But I think we're getting there. And, you know, here in Australia, I think we're doing a really good job.
So what are some of the mechanics of that diplomacy at a day-to-day level?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, this is one of the demystification exercises that I'm trying to go through in my very fortunate time in this position. I don't think the art of diplomacy is going to look entirely different. It just requires that we move much quicker and that non-traditional means of diplomacy are and can be equally and sometimes more effective than the very traditional forms of diplomacy. And it's just accepting that degree of flexibility of policymaking needs to be brought into your diplomacy as well. And fast-moving connections and the ability to shift those connections very, very rapidly is incredibly important. Now, you know, I would say that's modern diplomacy, and especially in the current context of contested environment, it's, you know, having a clear mind and a very clear voice, and applying your very clear principles in those conversations that you have is vital. So and this is something that I think is really important that, you know, when we teach grads, for example, about what does cyber diplomacy look like, it's saying to everyone, you're all cyber diplomats. You know, you will understand the digital environment more than most. So go and use that interest and go and apply it in everything that you do in your jobs.
And I guess that has implications for the structure and culture of organizations that do diplomacy as well.
Yeah, no, undoubtedly.
So to go back to our other point then, yeah, so how do you build that united national approach in a liberal democracy where the whole is at least as great as some of its parts?
Yeah. So, I mean, there will always necessarily be direct government interest where that has to be upheld and necessarily so, rightfully so. But in this area, you know, especially when we're looking at cyberspace or any of the critical technologies that we're dealing with, there's got to be an acknowledgement that a huge amount of the capability and the technology exists beyond our reach. It's in the private sector. It's with the tech industry, infrastructure developers and the like. Therefore, they've necessarily got a loud voice in how this kind of position, my position, is put together and what those interests might be. But also with something like the internet, well, you know, everyone's got an interest in that, haven't they? I bet any listener, well, don't bet, I know that every listener to this podcast will be engaging with the internet probably whilst they're listening to this podcast itself, right? Therefore, it means that you need to be willing to reach out and listen to those voices. And I know certainly when I started this job, there were a few colleagues who were scratching their heads at who some of the visitors were consecutively coming to my office. in the first months of this position. And it was genuinely tech leaders and industry figures and NGOs, academics, to try and get a perspective on, well, what do you think a job like this should look for? How do I take that term multi-stakeholder and try and embody it and deliver that in the international environment? Because that's to our advantage. Because if I can stand up in front of, you know, an authoritarian regime that has a very distinct view that the state should run everything in cyber and tech issues and say, well, you know, we have a multi-stakeholder approach, and I can tell you that, you know, our position as informed by industry as much as government is this. If you can stand up and embody that, then that's pretty powerful, rather than saying the term as just an empty phrase. So I think it's constant engagement. It's listening. It's being willing at times to take words or phrases from industry, pop them into some of your strategy documents so they can see that, you know, their ideas are in there. It's not that you're just listening for the sake of it, for going through a process. It's genuine consultation and engagement with industry.
And multi-stakeholder is one of those very loaded and, if you like, contested terms, right? It means something in international diplomacy. You should maybe explain specifically what it means and why some countries are uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, multi-stakeholder is a term often. It's kind of one of those terminology bingo games that's played in the cyber discussion, because you hear it so much and everyone sighs and, oh, goodness, yeah, multi-stakeholder. Well, what it is it's a reflection of the way in which the internet was constructed, which is partly U.S. government initiative, but it's governed by a whole complex array of non-government organizations, NGOs, and private sector companies, and it works. It's a smorgasbord of different interests and organizations of different ilks. But what you have are a number of other nations who feel that isn't the right way, and it advantages Western countries too heavily, and that the internet should be under far more direct state control, and that it should be a state-owned and governed environment. You know, just imagine what the internet might have looked like if government had invented it and maintained it. You know, I mean, one of the things we enjoy is that kind of free flow of ideas, innovation, and it's led to the kind of economies and lifestyles that we enjoy. And the internet is one of the main reasons that we are where we are now, I would suggest, from an economic perspective and from a communications perspective. And that multi-stakeholderism is what, you know, Western like-minded nations try and embody in that international environment. There's a whole array of different interests here, and we need to keep those present. As I say, there are very strong voices, though, from a whole other set of governments who really don't want that to be the case, and would far rather that they had far more distinct say.
So we'll turn, before we close this discussion, we'll turn to Australia's region, we'll turn to the Indo-Pacific, and I guess there's two questions I have there. One is to look at really how we do our cyber and critical tech diplomacy in our region. You know, where are we reaching to? What are the points of traction? What are some of the challenges? But also a particular initiative that's evoked quite a lot of interest lately, which is the way that the quadrilateral dialogue is of the United States, Japan, India, and Australia is now explicitly including cyber and technologies among its, I guess, its ambit of issues that it wants to cooperate on. That's evoked a lot of interest, and I should, of course, just declare for the record that my own college, the National Security College, is doing some quad research, quad tech network research, which is supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in, I guess, a track two variant of that kind of cooperation. But what is the narrative for Australia pursuing cybersecurity and cyber diplomacy in the Indo-Pacific and with the Quad in particular?
Yeah, look, absolutely. So the focus of our cyber and tech diplomacy is, if you like, global in perspective, but regional in focus, and necessarily so. So, you know, we have a whole array of different bilateral engagements, bilateral MOUs and very practical MOUs with all sorts of kind of practical avenues that we pursue together, bridge building, if you will. And you know, another area of work that we've built massively over the last 4.5 years is the way in which we assist other countries in our region develop their approach to cybersecurity, to cyber policy, and now increasingly to broader critical tech and standards around that. And as a government, we've invested enormously in this. We've taken our capacity building work from a $4 million investment in 2017 to now just shy of $100 million that we've invested in.
And can I interrupt you? What does capacity building mean for those of us who don't know diplomatic terminology?
So capacity building is working with our regional partners. It's essentially development assistance work. In trying to build a particular country's ability to, across a whole range of different issues, but it might be that we're looking to work with a country to help them address how they approach cyber policy. It may be that we're looking to work with a country to technically help them uplift their approach to cybersecurity, as we've done in Papua New Guinea in helping and working collaboratively with that government to build a cybersecurity operations center there. It could be about working with them to uplift their understanding of international law and norms and their ability to then engage in the multilateral discussion as well. And that's just, if you like, tip of an iceberg. And actually, that's one way we've harnessed our collaborative partners, including the ANU, to incredible effect. We've worked with over in the region of about 50 different partners, ranging from Qantas, Ernst & Young, Commonwealth Bank, to tiny little SMEs with just a handful of employees, to academia. It's been a real privilege to work with such an energetic, collaborative environment, building the Australian brand around the region and assisting countries genuinely be better equipped to respond to these issues. But you're right to bring up the issue of the Quad. You just need to look at the market power of those four nations, which is considerable, includes three of the biggest innovation hubs on the planet. All of us looking at critical technologies and what they're going to do for us domestically, and also all concerned about that international environment. So the leaders meeting produced a new working group, which is more exciting than perhaps a working group sounds. But really, what's that doing? That is powering our collaboration as four considerably tech-advanced nations to work on issues of, commonality, of course. So making statements around what it is we want to see out of that technology environment. How do we work collaboratively in standard setting bodies to ensure that we're more coordinated in those areas? How do we work on 5G telecommunications issues together and to assist others as well, along with a whole array of different issues? So it's really about getting practical work moving forward through the Quad in order that, we can help shape that tech environment in a positive way. And again, it goes back to the values piece. So we can help shape the tech environment in a way which fits with the values that we share.
So, I'm quite a strong advocate of the potential for the Quad and some of these other new and emerging coalitions to have an impact on the international environment and to advance interests and principles that we share. And I note that in the Quad leaders meeting, which you referred to, and the statement that's launched this technology, cyber and technologies working group, and other working groups too, incidentally, on COVID and climate and other issues. But there's, for example, an intention to develop agreed principles on technology design, development, and use, which I think could be a very powerful tool for coordinating the efforts of those countries and maybe others that it can sign on. At the same time, in the research that we're doing, we've identified, of course, as well that there are differences in national experience. It's not all commonalities. India does go its own way, for example, and of course, at the moment we're all looking and wishing well and hoping and trying to help our friends in India and the really tough situation they're going through with COVID, which will also, I think, have an effect on India's ability to be a partner in at least the short term. So whether it's in the Quad or whether it's in some of these other new cooperative arrangements, how do we also approach the challenge that not all of our partners are going to have identical interpretations of the values or principles that we hold when values and principles are so important to our policy. I mean, there is a diplomatic challenge there going forward, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I'll come back to the term flexibility. It's not, you know, when you're never going to win 100% of what it is you want in any negotiation. I mean, I think you'd be foolhardy to think that would be the case. So there will always be, you know, a debate to be had in terms of, you know, you're right to say it's not, you know, it's not that everyone in the world shares the same values. So it wouldn't be as interesting a world as it is if that was the case. But, you know, there's a common enough basis amongst the Quad to begin that conversation and make those joint statements. And even the process of making those joint statements, right, gives you that basis and can introduce new thinking, new terms into the lexicon of nations that perhaps hadn't thought about particular aspects of technology and the values that it can convey and should uphold. So I think it provides us actually with a fantastic opportunity for that negotiation and that conversation. And I'm pretty excited to see where we come out the other end. And I must add as well, you know, the work that the ANU has done and your group have done, Rory, on the QTN has been mentioned by colleagues without any prompting. It's definitely struck a chord. So it's great having that outside, you know, kind of thinking to push government along. It's very helpful.
Well, it is such a connected world these days, Ambassador. So I think a metric of success for us is meeting diplomats from foreign countries who report back to us our own research that they've received in translation through their own networks. But look, I just wanted to wrap up on a question about how do we measure progress and success, because it's going to be a continually contested area, and you've acknowledged the hard work of multilateral diplomacy in this and other spaces. So how will you measure success for this particular strategy and for the work you do generally?
Yeah, I mean, there's various ways I can answer that. I'll answer it first from the very practical side, which is anyone who has the time or inclination and reads through this strategy will see that it has some high-level thinking and what it is that we want to achieve, but also has some very practical actions of how we think those highfalutin objectives can be achieved. And we've promised ourselves inside government to keep a check on how we're progressing around all of those actions very regularly, and we're razor-sharp focused on that implementation. And actually, through our last strategy, we published where we were up to halfway through the life cycle of that strategy so that it was there for others to look at. And we'll do the same with this one as well. You know, it's part of the transparency that I think is important to keep ourselves to account. I think more broadly, So what does success look like? And I think in some ways only time will tell, because we are just starting to get into very deep international discussions around what AI ethics look like, for example. And you can already feel the multilateralism, you know, growing in the room, and the contestability and the geopolitics play out. I would tend to look 10, 15, 20 years in the future. If we've been successful in getting this commonality of cause into everyone's vocabulary in government, and understanding how central this is to the whole power shift and power dynamic that's going on currently in the world, then in 15, 20 years' time, we won't be living in a global society where an authoritarian vision of what these technologies should be doing for us is more present than the one that we would like to view, which is as an enabler, an economic multiplier, and something which is as a benefit to us all and allows us to function in the way that we think we should.
Look, thanks for that. And I think it's a fascinating piece of the long game that it's good to imagine Australian diplomacy is playing in these really challenging times. So with that, we'll close. Ambassador Feakin, Dr. Tobias Feakin, Australia's Ambassador for Cyber Affairs and Critical Technology, thanks for joining us on the podcast on National Security Summit.
Thanks so much, Rory. Pleasure to be here.
Well, that's it for today. We'll pop a link to the Cyber and Critical Tech Strategy in the show notes. If you haven't already, please give the National Security Podcast a rating on your favourite podcast platform. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please do. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.